that way. Please do on your way out. He will be glad to receive your admission fee of $5 ahead. Or if you want to be a regular, for $35, you can get a 6-month subscription, which is a little over half price, so you save almost 100%. Appreciate as many of you finding our new location. Obviously, if you weren't able to find us, you're not here, but glad as many of you did, found us as did. Hope to see most of you back next week for the lecture by Matthew Lockhart from the SMU Philosophy Faculty on some paradoxes of epistemic closure. But this evening, we're privileged to have with us Dr. Robert Radford, who did his graduate work at the University of Texas in the 1960s and retired as a philosophy professor from Oklahoma State University. And he'll be presenting to us on the intriguing title, Does God Have a Dog in This Fight?
Would you see if I can pass out these two notes?
All right.
Well, he's passing out the handout so that you'll at least have something you can take away from this. I thought I'd tell you a little bit about my background because it may have some relevance to what I'm going to be talking about tonight. I'm a Dallas native. I was born at St. Paul's Hospital and it was on Bryant Street, which is probably a bit before the time of some of you. I attended a Southern Baptist Church here in Dallas on Ross Avenue. I attended and graduated from Woodrow Wilson High School a few years back. I entered my fundamentalist phase while I was a student at Baylor University in Waco and was liberated by some philosophical and historical study while I was still there and some study elsewhere as well. This paper was originally presented or prepared for presentation to a political science seminar at OSU a couple of years or so back, well after I had retired from teaching at the university. But they asked for it, and so I tried to put it together. It was a little different in that the paper was submitted by email in advance to those who were anticipated being showing up, so they had a chance to read it, which was probably fortunate because it ended up going about 100 pages. So what I did tonight is a condensed version of that, and hopefully with the notes we can make that work reasonably decently. I'll say a little bit about the handouts when they become a bit more relevant. The germ that sprouted into this talk in a much longer paper was actually my daughter's birthday gift to me several summers ago of this particular book by Rabbi Michael Lerner called The Left Hand of God. A very good book, fascinating, enlightening, and it sort of got me on the journey of beginning to think seriously about the religious right. Part of what was intriguing to me about Lerner's account was that he offered a diagnosis of why the religious right was attractive to large numbers of people in our society. The religious right in America, and some call it the Christian right, and there are several other names used as well, has developed over roughly the last 30 years. It's composed, as I see it, of several component groups. One, most white conservative evangelical Christians, including a subgroup that are usually referred to as fundamentalists. Secondly, many white charismatic and Pentecostal Christians. Third, some traditional Roman Catholics. Four, many Mormons. Five, many members of megachurches, and a good many television and radio evangelists, and those tend to be overlapping groups. The religious right is mostly organized in extra-denominational groups. The best known of these, and you'll find a longer list in one of those handouts, the one that starts with the religious right organization, Appendix 2, But the best-known ones, I think, are probably the Christian Coalition, Eagle Forum, Family Research Council, Focus on the Family, Moral Majority, Promise Keepers, and the Southern Baptist Convention. A list of over 40 such organizations is in the handouts. Now, of the 50 or so religious right leaders, the best known ones in this part of the country, I suspect, are David Barton, Chuck Colson, James Dobson, John Hagee, Tim LaHaye, Richard Land, Paige Patterson, Tony Perkins, Pat Robertson, Phyllis Schlafly, and Donald Wildman. Two of the big names in the field that died in recent years, Jerry Falwell and D. James Kennedy. Now I want to talk a bit about characteristics of the religious right. And that's what I'm mainly going to try to focus on during most of the talk. And I derived this list of characteristics from my own examination of various pronouncements and publications of the leaders of the religious right organizations. And the handout includes a list of the organizations, a little bit of information about them in terms of some of their finances a few years back when I first did the research on that part of things, and I haven't gone back to update it since then. Then there's a list of the leaders of the religious right in the handout, and several other things. These organizations, led by the people identified, have some different emphases, methods, traits, track records. They have certainly undergone some important changes over the 30 years time period. And one should not expect that all of these people agree on all of the issues that are raised by the religious right. Some have openly criticized others. Some have done that less publicly. To some extent, they compete with each other for supporters and funding. A couple of largely secretive groups have developed to try to coordinate their efforts. And they are, one, the Council for Public Policy, Council for National Policy, which was started by Tim LaHaye in 1981, and more recently the Arlington Group, started in 2003 and headed by James Dobson. These two groups meet several times a year and also work by conference calls, frequently inviting prominent Republican politicians to join their gatherings. Excuse me, I want to get my glass of water because my throat's getting a bit dry here. Now, instead of trying to develop a sharp analytic definition, as some philosophers will want, of the religious right, I will instead treat the religious right on the philosophical model of a set of family resemblances. That is, I want to call attention to a group of characteristics that frequently recur in the members, but not all of the characteristics, or maybe none of them, belonging to all of the members of the religious right. Some members share a number, perhaps most of the characteristics, with some like some of the features that show up in others. The concept of the religious right thus has rather fuzzy edges, not unlike many concepts that philosophers wrestle with. Some who would understandably and appropriately deny that they're members of the religious right may also share some of these characteristics. In fact, the various combinations of these characteristics found in individual members of the religious right may well not even be logically compatible among themselves or with other views that they hold. Now, I want to talk briefly about these family resemblances, and they show up in a very abbreviated form on one of the handouts, the two-page or two-sheet set of charts that have on the first sheet the religious right on the left side, and some characteristics that I find in the prophets and of Jesus in the Christian's Bible on the right-hand side. then you'll notice on the second sheet of the paper, those are reversed. And we'll go around talking about some of that a little later. I'm sorry, I didn't have enough. I was told to expect 25 or 30 people, so I ran out 30 copies, and that's all I have. Maybe you can share and...
We can probably give a message on the website.
Okay, if you want to do that later, it'll work fine. Okay, characteristics, family resemblance characteristics that I believe can be found among the members of the religious right, particularly their leaders. And I focus mainly on the leaders. And these, I think, are helpful to identify the religious right. First, there are what I'd call 15 primary characteristics there on the front of the sheet. One, they tend in their theological position to be evangelicals, with many of them being fundamentalists. That means they take Jesus of Nazareth to be the only Son of God, and they hold that his teachings, along with the rest of the Bible, read literally, or normative for our lives. Secondly, they tend in their political position to be socially conservative and overwhelmingly Republican. Three, they frequently denigrate the federal court system, accusing it of undermining our country through juridical or judicial activism. Four, they zealously pursue getting people elected to public office from local school boards, state legislatures, and governors, all the way up to the presidency. That is, people who can convince the religious right leaders that they're enthusiastically committed to those leaders' values. They're strongly opposed, in the fifth place, to abortion, its legality and its practice. And this is frequently expressed as being pro-life. Six, they're strongly opposed to homosexuality, homosexual behavior, and anything that encourages or endorses it. This is frequently expressed as opposition to, quote, the homosexual lifestyle, or the homosexual agenda, and or same-sex unions or marriage. Seven, they're extremely distrustful of modern science, including such areas as evolutionary biology, psychosexual development, astronomy, global climate change, and fetal stem cell research. Eight, they're strongly in support of the nation of Israel and are anti-Arab. They are Zionist. Nine, they ardently oppose what they call secular humanism and see it as the source of most of the evils in the modern world. Ten, they favor strengthening the family, understood as a nuclear family of one man married to one woman with as many children as they can produce. They identify themselves as pro-family or pro-traditional family. 11, they're strongly critical of pornography and demand to see legal means taken to stop it or at least significantly slow it down in TV and movies, on the internet, and in entertainment generally. 12, they are opposed to feminism and equal treatment of women, especially in their churches or religious organizations. They oppose the Equal Rights Amendment on a state or federal level. 13, they're committed to Christianizing the public schools, or if that's not possible, to divert public school funding via vouchers and other means to private schools, including religious ones. 14, they want to destroy the legal doctrine of the separation of church and state and move this country toward what they see as a restoration of a Christian nation. This includes expanding the funneling of tax monies at the state and federal level into supporting religious activities and sanctioning political campaigning by religious leaders and institutions. And they believe this should not affect the tax-exempt status of any of those religious institutions. 15, they strongly support largely unfettered capitalism, what they frequently call a free market economy, or what some economists call market fundamentalism. Then there are 15 what I'd call secondary characteristics. They tend to use the term Christian to apply only to those who share their theological commitments. Thereby they typically imply, and sometimes say, Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox Christians, Mormons, Episcopalians, Methodists, Disciples of Christ, Christian Scientists, Quakers, and many others, are outside the scope of the Christian religion. 17, they want to maintain as much racial segregation as possible, including their private, largely segregated schools, for which they want to keep tax-exempt status. 18, they are ardently pro-nationalistic, pro-patriotic Americans. 19, they are vocally in favor of a strong, aggressive military. They supported the Vietnam War, they support the Iraq War, and the Afghanistan War. 20, they ardently embrace the widespread use of the symbols of civil religion, such as displays of the Ten Commandments in public facilities, official prayers at public school events, keeping under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and officially sanctioned Bible reading in public schools. They strongly favor the use of capital punishment for a variety of crimes at the state and federal level. They strongly support the use of torture, or some euphemism for it, to seek information from or to get revenge on persons who are suspects. They support tax cuts for the wealthy in this country. They want to see the Federal Department of Education abolished. They want to see the National Endowment for the Arts abolished. They are opposed to the introduction of what they call a new world order. They believe in and are very unhappy about what they call a war on Christmas. You may have heard about this recently. This is seen as part of a much larger culture war in this country. They are in favor of much tighter controls on immigration, denying, quote, illegal immigrants, or their children, any state or federal assistance, and they favor kicking illegal immigrants out of this country. They believe that caring for the poor should be a matter of private activity by individual citizens and not a matter for action by government at any level. Finally, they are heavily involved in mythologizing American history to create the view that this country was founded by Christians, in their sense, Christian gentlemen, and that it remained a Christian nation until about 60 years or so ago. Now, let's turn to a bit of a kind of overall critical assessment of the religious right. Now, some of this will be fairly cryptic because whole sections of the longer paper are designed to spell out some of the points that are briefly alluded to here. First, and I should say before I get to that one, that I view any competent, decent, critical analysis of a political, religious, or intellectual position as one that should include attention to both positive and negative features of the position. So let me summarize some of those. First, to a large extent, our culture has increasingly engendered what Lerner described as a bottom-line mentality that judges every activity, every institution, every social practice as rational, productive, or efficient only to the extent that it produces money or power. This way of organizing our society promotes selfishness, materialism, and disconnection. This has engendered a sense of isolation, meaninglessness, and purposelessness in the lives of many people. Many in the religious right have sought to address people's deep-seated need for a sense of meaning in their lives and a longing for a strong sense of connection with their fellow human beings. In some ways, that attention to meaninglessness is the hook with which people get reeled in to the religious right. They have clearly brought lots of people together in political campaigns over the last 30 years. For those not finding meaning in the political process, the religious right has also pushed their religious agenda, which is primarily American religious fundamentalism. Now, I think they falsely assumed that in order to find meaning in one's life, one must base it on a sense of absolute certainty regarding God and His will for people's lives. Unfortunately, a careful study of their basis for that certainty in an inerrant Bible, read literally, has serious inadequacies. At most, I think they get a psychological confidence in what they have been taught to believe. But their bibliolatry cannot provide epistemological certainty, as anyone critically examining their claims realizes. Now, second error. Closely related to the above, the religious right has made explicit attention to moral values important in political campaigns, in legislating, and in governing. I believe we will be better in the long run for focusing openly on the role of values in our shared lives, especially as the overwhelming majority of us participate in that process. The downside of this is that the religious right's agenda of moral values is badly flawed. It leaves out significant major areas of moral value. It includes immoral values, and it distorts some, at least, of the moral values it does emphasize. Their so-called moral values, I find, are more a reflection of their traditional Southern culture than they are of the teachings of Jesus or the prophets that are prominent in the Christian sacred literature. Increasingly, evangelicals, but not the fundamentalists, are waking up to some aspects of this unduly constricted conception of moral values in the religious right. Now, third area. The religious right has awakened many religious people to their responsibilities as citizens, including voting and paying attention to the value commitments of political candidates and their elected leaders. This has, I think, potential for helping to re-energize our Republican form of government. Nevertheless, a vibrant republic also depends upon a citizenry as well informed as well as active, including having a clear awareness of the fundamental principles of our Republican form of government. On that score, the religious right has ill-served us by fostering a rather distorted conception of our form of government and the importance of such fundamental principles as separation of powers, responsibility of the judiciary in protecting and interpreting the Constitution, and the crucial importance of the separation of church and state in order to protect both the church's and the state's integrity. The dishonesty, the deceitfulness, the distortions, the superficial analyses of problems, and the frequent misinformation on all kinds of issues perpetrated by the leaders of the religious right is scarcely compatible with developing a well-informed electorate prepared to carry out their civic responsibilities. A fourth area. We should be grateful to the religious right for reminding us that our citizens should take seriously their individual moral responsibilities as persons. Their emphasis on the individual responsibilities of Christians is important. This is a significant part of an informed approach to solving our social and political problems in this country. Nevertheless, while the religious right recognizes the importance of government responsibilities on some of their selected issues, like abortion, same-sex marriage, pornography, they are derelict in denying it on other relevant issues, such as dealing with poverty, AIDS, and the environment. Dealing with the major issues facing our society requires both individuals picking up their responsibilities and the government doing what individuals are utterly incapable of doing on their own or in their charitable groups, such as making systemic economic and social changes to address poverty, racism, health care, environmental degradation. Fifth area. The religious right is correct to be concerned with the increasing materialism in our society, but they underestimate its sources and thereby what's necessary to significantly decrease it. This is related to the point above about overemphasizing individualism. Converting people to becoming Christians, in their sense, frequently does little to dent their materialistic outlook. Ironically, the most, quote, successful churches today, the mega churches, typically preach a gospel of how God wants you to become rich and what to do to achieve it. With their ministers parading around in their own wealth and openly describing their materialistic lifestyle. Such megachurches mirror our larger consumer society, including sometimes even having commercial franchises in their church complexes. The religious right fails to see that our overweening materialism is directly tied to the version of capitalism we have increasingly been practicing. We have become used to thinking of everything in our lives having a price and economic value, and the meaning of our lives by how much we can accumulate. In our individualistic pursuit of economic security and financial proofs of our significance, we can never accumulate enough. Such materialism is intimately linked with the widespread sense of the meaninglessness of our lives and our sense of isolation and aloneness that Lerner calls a spiritual crisis of our time. Sixth, the religious right has played an important role in the widespread perception of cultural breakdown in recent decades. At the present time, it almost seems that anything goes in our entertainment industry except explicit racist comments on most TV or radio stations by WASPs. The entertainment industry's programming is radically different from what it was 50 years ago, and much of it does not present on balance an uplifting or inspiring view of life. It's too often cheapening, vulgar, and degrading. But it sells. People support it enthusiastically. The entertainment industry, like most big business, seems to act without any sense of conscience about their product or its effects, but rather with their eyes consistently glued to the bottom line. Like most of the large businesses in this country, the entertainment industry pours hundreds of millions of dollars into funding primarily Republican politicians that are the darlings of the religious right. And those politicians rather consistently vote to guarantee the continued profit-making potential of the major culture machines. If and when culture changes significantly, the entertainment industry will find it profitable to change with it. Besides, laws are relatively anemic tools for changing the culture in this or any other Republican nation. Now I want to turn to some of the material that's on the comparison chart that I handed out earlier, or I had passed around. And just to try to point up that when you compare issue by issue the agenda of the religious right, the characteristics I've cited, with primary emphases in the Hebrew prophets and in the Gospels about what Jesus taught and practiced, it strikes me that one finds very little, if any, positive correlation between the two. There's little, if any, common ground at all between what the religious right's advocating and what the prophets and Jesus in the Jewish and Christian tradition emphasized. And that's what I'm trying to call to your attention in those handouts. Then on the second sheet of that, where you look at the teachings of Jesus and the prophets on a number of key issues that relate to things that show up in the literature of the religious right, again, that gets underscored. There's very little common ground between the two at all. Now, I'm not going to go over that in detail. We can talk about specific points if you want to do that later. But let me move toward a concluding section of this talk, and then we'll have hopefully more time for discussion. Given that the religious right has demonstrably failed to achieve most of what they claim they were trying to accomplish, look through their agenda, I think that one has to look for an alternative explanation for their activity than the one they offer, or the ones they offer. Given further that their agenda is seriously inconsistent with the teachings of Jesus and the prophets and much of the Torah, it's utterly implausible for them to claim that they're just doing their best to carry out the mission Christ gave them. One place to look for that explanation, seems to me, is to find out what they have been successful at achieving. What the leaders of the religious right have been most successful at is bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars a year into their coalitions, ministries, forums, broadcasting empires, etc. According to available public records, when I did the detailed work on this, and this covers only some of the organizations that constitute the religious right, those organizations showed in their federal tax filings a cumulative income for the 2005 income tax year of $785 million. The leaders of the religious right have amassed enormous amounts of money over the roughly three decades of their existence, $785 one year. A number of their leaders live a lavish lifestyle. In addition, these leaders have become quite famous public figures. And this connection is quite revealing, how this fundraising success is closely related to their enthusiasm for trying to find a constitutional way to prevent same-sex marriage, for example, what was called the Federal Marriage Amendment. It was, one might say, a marriage of convenience between GOP politicians who needed something to shore up their conservative base and religious right leaders whose organizations were flatlining on fundraising abilities and needed something to shake loose the purse strings of conservative folks across the country. Campaigning against same-sex marriage worked like a charm for both of them in recent years. I think this has direct relevance to understanding what the religious right's been doing these last three decades. Alignment with the Republican Party has been a lucrative arrangement. It has enhanced their visibility and their fundraising base. Among other things, it's increased their contacts with wealthy business persons eager to support agendas that will enhance their own profits. Now, I don't profess to know what people like Falwell, Robertson, Dobson, Kennedy, Land et al. Understand, or when they were alive, understood about themselves. I don't think it matters a great deal for our analysis. Perhaps they suffer from gigantic self-delusion, I don't know. Still, what they have been doing has brought in piles of money and considerable fame or infamy. As a matter of fact, in light of their failure to accomplish much of their announced agenda for 30 years, that seems to me to go a long way toward making sense of their activities in the kind of materialistic world that they both decry and by their agenda and actions strongly endorse. The New Testament Gospels are quite unanimous in making it clear what Jesus of Nazareth thought about that sort of money grubbing, as well as what the scriptures that he knew said about it. In addition to what he explicitly taught, there were also his actions. What would Jesus do about these religious leaders who purport to tell us what God wants of us? I think he would expect that we would follow precedent and drive the money changers out of the temple. Many ministers remind us that our hands are God's hands. I cannot conceive of a Christian's God, or God of Judaism, needing or desiring his disciples or religious leaders to lie or deceive or misrepresent significant matters to those to whom they profess to minister. It's all the worse when they do such things while professing to speak for the one who said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Now, to the title. I dare say God has several dogs in this fight. First, there's truth. And truth is confronting his enemies, the leaders of the religious right. Then there's love, as in loving our neighbors as we love ourselves, and as in do to others as you would have them do unto you. And that brings us to peace and nonviolence, as in turn the other cheek, walk the extra mile, blessed are the peacemakers, etc. And finally, in this short list, there's the kingdom of God. That's the one that is not of this world, the one that's sharply contrasted in virtually all ways from the oppressive, dominating empires of this world, including the American one of today. The kingdom of God is the one where the least, the poor, the sick, the homeless, the immigrants, the imprisoned, become first. That's the one where those who serve those are the highest in God's kingdom. Now let me conclude this talk with a couple of factual stories that I think help to highlight the contrast that I've been speaking about. First, let's look at a poignant account of the stark absence of love manifested in one of the bulwarks of the religious right. It concerns the family of a man named Jimmy Allen, who was a former president of the Southern Baptist Convention immediately before the takeover by the Republican right of that convention. Jimmy Allen's daughter-in-law, Lydia, who was a nurse, and her two children contracted AIDS as a result of a blood transfusion that she had in the mid-1980s when she was pregnant with her first child. Her husband, Scott Allen, was then forced out of his position as the associate minister of a church in Colorado. So they moved back home to the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas to be with Jimmy and the rest of the family. And when they got back to the Dallas area, they could not find a Southern Baptist church here that would accept their oldest preschool child in Sunday school for a number of years. Even with the enthusiastic help of their very well-placed family leader, who contacted numerous Southern Baptist pastors that he knew quite well, the family members were treated as if they had leprosy and were untouchable. Jimmy Allen writes, and he has a book about this, that the rejection of the churches when we reached out for help was one of the most devastating aspects of our entire ordeal with AIDS, especially for me. He went on to note, quote, "Despite our publicly announced intentions to follow Jesus, to live as he did, most churches were following the dictates of fear. Jesus voluntarily touched lepers, but he did not die of leprosy. He died at the hands of religious leaders who were so anxious to hold on to their power that they wouldn't touch a leper to save their lives." When Jimmy Allen's grandson, Matt, was old enough for school, according to Allen, God seemed to surround Matt with people who would show him the compassion and care he was not able to find in the church. Lakewood Elementary School, a public school, exemplified far more of the Spirit of Christ than did many of the institutions that bear his name. They were finally, by the way, accepted at a Church of Christ, where Larry James, now the president of Cityscape, formerly called Central Dallas Ministries, was then the minister. Matt attended Lakewood Elementary in Dallas as long as he was strong enough, which was until some months before he died at the age of 12. Allen reports without disagreement the perspective of his son, Scott, who had lost his wife and eventually two children to AIDS. That is just a business, like any other business. Age scares people away. Churches do what pleases the most customers. And Jimmy went on to write about that institution's abysmal failure. And I quote, "The real issue for Scott and Lydia turned out to be more than food, clothing, and shelter. It was the disappointment they felt when the system they had worked so hard to perpetuate failed to come through for them. They had spent their time and energy enlisting families in Christian activity. They had led the way in taking care of church nurseries, visiting in homes to bring ministry to people, reaching out to anyone who needed help. But when they needed help, the church as an institution was not there for them. Christian individuals helped, but the organized church was unwilling to risk reaching out to Scott and Lydia. After ministering to multitudes of others, there was no place where they and their child could go for nurture and worship. The church's doors slammed in their faces, and it left an indelible mark on my family. When others were publicly asserting that those who got AIDS were being punished for their sins, Alan couldn't miss the sharp contrast with the way Jesus responded to those in need that he encountered during his ministry. Quote, "He held no inquisitions with women taking the act of adultery, thieves dying beside him on the cross, or greedy men straining to see him in a crowd. He simply forgave. He never probed for probable causes or wanted or wasted bodies with crooked limbs, lepers with flesh falling off their bones, or people with eyes unable to see the sunlight. Jesus simply healed." Now the second story, a more recent one. This comes from the Amish area of Pennsylvania in October of 2006. Charles Carl Roberts IV, after ordering the adults and male children out of a one-room Amish school house in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, massacred 5 girls and severely wounded 5 other girls before killing himself. On the day of the shooting, the grandfather of one of the murdered Amish girls was heard warning some young relatives of his not to hate the killer, saying, "We must not think evil of this man." Another Amish father noted he had a mother and a wife and a soul, and now he's standing before a just God. Jack Meyer, a member of the Brethren community living near the Amish in Lancaster County, explained, "I don't think there's anybody here that wants to do anything but forgive, and not only reach out to those who have suffered a loss in that way, but to reach out to the family of the man who committed these acts." Roberts' family spokesman said, "An Amish neighbor comforted the Roberts family hours after the shooting and extended forgiveness to them. Amish community members visited and comforted Roberts' widow, parents, and parents-in-law. One Amish man held Robert's sobbing father in his arms, reportedly for as long as an hour, to comfort him. The Amish have also set up a charitable fund for the family of the shooter. About 30 members of the Amish community attended Robert's funeral and said Marie Roberts, the widow of the killer, was one of the few outsiders invited to the funeral of one of the victims. Marie Roberts later wrote an open letter to her Amish neighbors, thanking them for their forgiveness, their grace, their mercy. She wrote, "Your love for our family has helped to provide the healing we so desperately need. Gifts have been given and touched our hearts in a way that no words can describe. Your compassion has reached beyond our family, beyond our community, and is changing the world. For this, we sincerely thank you." Now, questions if you'd like, or comments? Yes, sir.
It's interesting that you point out the Amish, who are probably the most racist group of Christians in North America. In fact, they're so opposed to marrying outside of their own little group that there's some speculation that they may be become extinct because of the abnormally high amounts of birth defects because of their intermarriage. They're very intolerant people. And it just amazes me.
In some areas.
Right. It's just like every other Christian is intolerant in other areas as well. I mean, religion is the number one, the irrationality of religion is the number one cause of violent death in the world today. And to assume that someone is perverting this irrationality is kind of silly to me. I mean,
I don't buy the premise that religion is inherently irrational.
Well, I mean, you know, let's make up a religion. I mean, it's like all the ones, like the ones you mentioned, were all founded in the 1840s as a result of the industrialization of America. They took what was a pure agrarian religion and adapted it to industrialization. And, you know, it continues to evolve. So
yes.
Today's religion is considerably different than what it was 300 years, in AD 300, when it was the state religion of Rome. You know, when they took what was attributed to Caesar and put it on Jesus, the son of Zeus, you know, to Apollo.
Yes, sir. I think the more relevant question, though, do the Amish, or do they favor getting the government to intervene and force their values on other people? If they don't, then they're certainly a counterexample to the fundamentalist right.
Yes, sir.
If we were to take the 30 characteristics here and have a questionnaire to each person in the room and have them to check off which ones they believe, at what percentage would we separate religious right from those that wouldn't consider themselves religious right?
I don't know.
You see what I'm saying? You know,
I did indicate when I was introducing those that there's no unanimity among all these folks, and some of the things I've cited may very well be part of the beliefs of some of us who don't think of ourselves as part of the religious right. It's got fuzzy edges, that's part of the point I made, and that's typical of most of our concepts, I think.
Do you think that a large quantity of the 30 would be found in the 40s in a large population of the United States?
No.
Okay, so you say it was more diverse than in the 40s in the consideration of the 30 characteristics, that the religious right really didn't exist in the 40s.
That's my understanding. After the Scopes trial in 25, the fundamentalists, by and large, went sort of underground as far as politics was concerned. They got about their own business, setting up their own journals, their own publication houses, their own radio broadcasts, their own literature, and did not emerge back into widespread public life until the rise of this in the late 70s.
Didn't have dominant leaders to push their movement, although the characteristics probably existed there.
Some of them, yeah.
Okay.
But they just didn't see themselves having a political agenda.
Okay. Now, would the political agenda, if there was, would the political agenda be the Democratic Party because of the Southern Democratic cold?
Well, my understanding of reading the history, and I've looked at several different experts' accounts on the historical development here, is that, by and large, these folks just tuned out of politics.
Okay.
They didn't vote. They didn't campaign. They just didn't participate. And the religious right was formed in the late 70s at the instigation of a couple of well-placed Republican strategists who wanted to find a way to separate the conservative political views of people from the Democratic Party and move them to the Republican Party. And that's what they set out to do and recruited people like Falwell and others to get this organization going and get the movement going.
So they're moving the old Dixie crafts over to the Republic.
Precisely, yeah. Okay.
Could you comment on the Tea Party and the religious influence of that, sir?
Well, I read a recent poll which indicated that about 47% of the self-identified Tea Party members also identify themselves as members of the religious right. Their agendas are remarkably similar. So I think there's a good bit of overlap, and to some extent the Tea Party, I think, may have helped to sort of bail out the religious right, which seemed to be a kind of a downhill slide nationwide, not in Texas, of course, in the rest of the nation, I think. Yes, sir.
Two comments. Some of these things of being fiscally conservative or maybe socially conservative, not necessarily religiously conservative, you know, if they're not mutually together, I mean, they can be, you know, person can be fiscally conservative and not, you know, anti-abortion, for example.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, secularists, modernists were thinking, you know, religion's going to go away.
Yes.
But,
they're dead wrong.
God's dead. But the opposite has happened recently, not only among Christians, and this is primarily you're talking about America.
Yes.
But fundamentalist Muslims and fundamentalist Jews also. And I think this is a reaction against secularism, modernization, the internet, quote, modernization, and it's kind of a defensive attitude that they have to try to entrench their values. They're in a defensive mode. I mean, not only...
not as much so as they were in the 20s, 30s,
yeah,
and 40s.
More so. And not just... not just Christians, but all religious conservatives. You want to comment on that?
I think there are very strong, influential fundamentalist movements in a number of religions. One of the books on the abbreviated bibliography, which is very abbreviated, is a book by Corinne Armstrong, which talks about the rise of fundamentalism in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, starting in 1492. So, now these have been around a good while. Yes?
Yeah. Getting back to this list of what would you check off, I'm finding that...
So you have your pen in your hand.
Well, I wrote down the name of the book. A lot of this terminology has been co-opted by the religious right. For example, I might say, well, I believe in family values, and I think it's good that children have a stable household, whether that's a traditional two-parent man-woman family, whether it's a gay family, whatever it is. I can say that I'm a Christian, I'm spiritual, but I'm not that Christian that they're talking about. So there are things like that, or patriotic is another one. Unless you're their brand of patriotic, you're not patriotic.
Yeah.
So I might check off things, but I don't mean what they mean.
Right.
So all my terminology has been taken away from me.
That's one of the difficulties, and that's why I think it's important to sort of confront this head on.
Yeah.
Interestingly, every Monday morning I go downtown to the Stupa and do a little Bible study with some of the homeless people that want to show up. Nobody's required to show. They do get a cup of coffee to show. And usually half dozen to a dozen people show up. And we've been reading through the prophets for a couple of years now, actually. We're working on Ezekiel right now. And one of the passages we talked about Monday was a claim that Ezekiel put forward as what the Lord told him, which is to not keep the values of your families. They've screwed up royally for generations. You've got to break that. You've got to get away from their values. And I suggested to the people that were there that so much for the family values issue. You get similar things, by the way, in the Gospels, where Jesus, his family's trying to see if they can get him off to the side and get him committed somewhere. And he explains he's got a different family now. Those are his followers. That's his family. That doesn't fit well with what the religious right is doing with family values at all.
I work for a guy who's a committed follower of the religious right, you know, and so we talk every day about this stuff. And one thing, you mentioned one of the points was that the religious right wants a restoration of this Christian government and pretend that we're a Christian nation. Where, if anywhere, does that come from in the scriptures, that the national government of America or any earthly government at this stage in the game should return to being devout followers?
I don't know that it does.
The Council of Nicaea, 300.
Yeah, right.
That's not scripture.
That's determined what is scripture. Yeah. The Council of Nicaea. That's what set up the state religion.
That came along later, actually. The Council was 325, the earliest mention of the scriptures we have was 50 years later. And I was in one diocese in Alexandria, Egypt.
They cut half the books out of it to make it go along with what the government wanted. The state religion.
Well, Constantine did the same thing to form the Bible.
Well, that's what he's saying. The Council of Nicaea was Constantine's deal.
Yeah. We can go back.
But in spite of Dan Brown, that didn't do it. That's not when it got settled.
So, accepting, for my question, let's accept the 66 books, and let's say they were around in 167 when Ambrose was around. Let's, based on that, where does this idea of revival, restoration for America come from?
Jonathan.
Probably somewhere in John's acid trip, a.k.a. Revelation.
Right.
I'm not sure you'll find it even there.
Yeah.
What I find in the Gospels and implicitly in the prophets as well is talking about a kingdom of God. In a sense in which God's concerned about people in all nations, not just one particular group. And he operates, according to the prophets, through leaders in all sorts of nations. One of the only people identified, interestingly, in the Old Testament as Messiah was Cyrus, king of Persia. He's actually named as Messiah, which tends to blow the mind of a lot of people that haven't come across that before. Some people seem to think they have a monopoly on that in their own religion. Yes?
Have you made any analysis of what are now called think tanks? We have a couple in Dallas. There's a bunch circle around Washington as to which ones are portraying what you describe as far right, and which ones have other philosophical views. They attract a lot of philosophers, a lot of economists.
I don't know that much about what's around Dallas per se. Well, there are some religious right organizations operating out of this area, though, and I think a few of them are on the list. I think some of the organizations I named in that list of organizations might, in some sense, qualify as think tanks. They're certainly actively involved in trying to lobby Capitol Hill and the president in regard to various issues they're interested in. But I'm not right off the top of my head prepared to give you a list of particular ones that are.
Perhaps the rule of thumb on Jerry's question is if you see them on Fox News, they're in that category.
I'll pass on that one.
if there was one attitude change or change of focus, if it were possible, that would correct the religious right's attitude or focus, what would that be?
I don't know. You got a long list of things to do, and changing just one of them, I don't think is going to work any great miracles. I guess one thing that might help move things along considerably is if they somehow got converted to honesty and took the truth seriously. Where when they speak, it's a matter of conscience what they say. And I don't see much indication of that anywhere down the line with the religious right. The term that Stephen Colbert coined for that is truthiness. Those of you that are more into serious philosophy, there was a book by Harry Frankfurt on that topic, but he called his own bullshit. Okay, anybody got patience for some more?
No, no mention of the right to bear arms in regard to your ledger. I briefly went through the ledger, but I don't think I saw anything.
It's not in it.
Okay.
Probably so could have been added. Well,
we all know what the religious right, how they feel about the right to bear arms. So as far as your ledger goes, would Jesus defend the right to bear arms and defend himself?
Not my understanding of what Jesus and the Gospels is all about.
Time you have a cake, but shoot your hat.
No. Peacemakers turn the other cheek, go the extra mile.
Okay, so somebody's attacking you.
Yeah. As I read it, he's fundamentally nonviolent.
Okay. That sounds very logical, I believe.
Yes, sir?
There is a passage where Christ asked his followers to bear a sword or divide a sword, and that was after, as I remember, it was after he was no longer present with them and given him specific instructions, sort of general manual.
I forget which gospel that's in. I think it's a little earlier, actually.
It's Matthew 10:34, I think.
Okay. But when in the garden, the people come to arrest him, and one of his followers does pull out a sword and uses it, he shuts it down.
This is more or less for evangelical use in the world or in your life, be prepared to defend yourself. That's the implication of it. It's not, however, there's no offense. There's no offense.
It's interesting how you get some mixed signals in the different Gospels on that. When Jesus sent out the disciples to go out and spread the word, particularly around Galilee, he told them certain things to take with them, certain things not to take with them. And put in one of the Gospels, they're not even to take a staff, which was a defensive weapon. But in others, they were told to take a staff. So he had mixed signals there.
The first one, they were not supposed to take these back. And the general discussion after that was more the norm.
Yeah. Matthew and Luke didn't care for some of the things that were in Mark, so they just changed it. Yes?
First thing, I did kind of have a question, though. I mean, to what degree are you sort of fighting fundamentalism with fundamentalism? Right. So
to one extent, yeah.
Right. So while the religious right is definitely contradictory to a strict scriptural definition, aren't they still within the broader Christian tradition? It's had a pretty long history, right?
Yes.
Anti-science, racism, and so on. So in that sense, is the religious right really something new, or are they following really strictly to a standard Christian doctrine?
Well, they're new in that it's a explicit, deliberate political movement with what I see as a kind of a religious veneer to it. They certainly have not taken seriously the centuries-long tradition of careful thought on social political issues the Catholic Church has wrestled with over the last 100 years, and has developed some rather well-defined and carefully thought-out positions. None of that is reflected in what I see in the religious right, by and large. They just sort of blow all that off, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes? It seems to me, I've been kind of noticing this for years, it seems to me that the main problem that the religious right has is in distinguishing between what is recommended for the individual that is saved to his attitude and what should be done by government. In other words, the force of law should be used. And they blur the two, and they sort of run them together. They take a separation of what an individual should choose to believe and what proper function of government is. That would clear up a lot of this overlap and this gray area where they, some of the things where you notice that they're, because in a sense they're advocating the government for certain things.
Some things, but not others. Interestingly, the ones they want the government to enforce have absolutely nothing to do with the things the prophets are hitting the political and religious leaders about not doing that they should have been doing. The prophets are very much on the government taking the leadership here. The religious leaders focusing on what ought to be going on in terms of social justice in the society, and they give verse and chapter at great length about where they've screwed up, what they've not done, they should have been doing. And they're not talking about individual actions. They're talking about the actions of the leaders of the country. Now, those are theocracies, I grant you that, and that's a little different. But even where the religious right wants to use the government to enforce their views, they don't coincide with what you find in the prophets or in Jesus, as far as I can tell.
The interesting analysis on our website I have, where I discuss a model for resolving the question between absolute and relative morality, where I figured out that there's three basic principles, and those are the musts, or more accurately, the must-nots, and then everything else is its shoulds. Those vary with different religions and cultures and countries and everything. And the problem arises when one of these groups doesn't know the difference between the musts and the shoulds, and they try to impose their shoulds on everybody else. But if everybody would go by a symbol, some understanding, which a model may be approaching, of what falls under musts, and which is the legitimate concern of government, versus what falls under shoulds, and it's just a matter of individual choice, then everything would be fine.
I guess I'm not quite that optimistic, but...
what is your prediction? Are we headed for a theocracy? Is that inevitable? Is that likely based on history?
I don't think so. We're further down that road than I'd like to see us. I grant you that.
At least until the
Scientology. But I suspect it would probably end up with some kind of revolution before that, which is not a good alternative either.
You think the religious right was because the last vote to move everything to the Republican side? Or do you think it was the stupidity of the government?
Well, I think the Tea Party and religious right, which cross over considerably, I think probably tipped enough things to make a big difference there in terms of the overall votes. They were still a minority, but they were a tipping point, I think, for the way things went.
Steve, yeah, let me ask this question.
Sure.
I don't know how to express it exactly, but I had a boss one time when I was an engineer that said, have faith in God, everybody else bring data. So in the sense that you tried to quantify in the summary there of these organizations, and concluded somehow that there's not enough done for the poor, is that correct?
That's certainly correct, yeah.
There's just an anecdote. For the last 7 years, my wife and I have worked for humanitarian organizations, including Africa.
Right.
And some that support Latin America and Haiti. And I was wondering if you could take all these dollars that you just try to summarize in part and take these organizations just to see how much of it does serve the poor. Would you mind commenting on that if you try to quantify it?
I haven't tried to quantify that. My guess would be that it's a minuscule part that has to do with serving the poor. But I don't try to
look at Franklin Graham.
What I had access to were things that were available on the internet of tax filings by these 504 organizations.
Wouldn't that be a fair way to look at it if you want to quantify it?
That would probably
be. It is quantifiable, I believe.
The other side of that is that I've seen a number of accounts which indicated that if all of the charity contributions that all of the citizens in this country make and the total assets of all of their foundations were poured into trying to help deal with poverty, it still would not do it. It's not enough.
Yeah, but your subject is the religious right.
No.
I'm taking that piece of it, separating, bifurcating it out, and saying what percent of that's going to pour. Yeah. It seems like a fair, fair way to try to quantify your conclusion about the poor.
I'm not an engineer.
You don't have to be an engineer to step up to date. You can be an economist.
No, I don't have access. I don't have access to the
data. You can be a professor.
No. I looked at the tax reports, which is about all I think I could readily get hold of. And, you know, they have to talk about how much money they brought in, how much they're paying to administer the programs, how much they pay to the chief executives of the organization, and not a lot else.
Well, look at the Christian theologist Joseph Stalin did for the poor. I mean, you know, he came out of seminary, he applied those rules, and that's where he came up with Stalinistic communism, which is based on Christianity. And you can't alleviate poverty by giving money to the poor.
No, I'm not saying you can alleviate it, but the point was he made further to confirm it.
Right, the only thing that's been shown to alleviate poverty is free market.
The point I was trying to make is, you've got all this attempt to quantify in these summaries, of how much money they have, okay? And we're talking about just the religious right. If you took those same group and said that the total amount of money that's brought in, how much of it serves the poor, and your conclusion is not enough.
Well, no, if you said you quote $750 million, that's what Mavericks are worth.
I'm going to make an observation. From your perspective, Bob, which is the right and which is the left in this audience? Because I'm observing where the majority of the discussion's happening and where it's not. Is it from your perspective, right or left, or is it from our perspective?
I wasn't thinking in those terms.
It's very interesting.
What about yours?
If you're talking about right or left, you're leaving out.
The majority is
there's a whole lot of others.
Now, maybe it's the perspective of where the questions have been recognized. Geographic.
Okay. John, you have to be careful about anything in too broad a brush. Several of the right-wing religious groups, at least religious groups, or individuals, do an awful lot of good in the world. Maybe more so per capita, I don't know, I don't have a measure, than the non-religious right. Like these Baptist groups that go out and help.
Kind of disaster, yeah.
Disaster relief. Can't argue with that.
That's a very impressive job they've been doing.
That's one example.
My hat's off to them, yeah.
So, you know, our spiritual may not be quite so clean anyway.
Even that's not very clear cut, though. I mean, when they go out to these places and distort the markets, it increases the suffering. You know, it's like food aid causes farmers to go broke in the third world, which makes people poor.
That's a perspective.
It's a perspective from an economic standpoint of government. Yeah, because too much charity is still there.
Yeah, I'm involved.
I have a question about the reference back to the biblical scriptures and so on.
Yes.
It seems to me that at the time of Jesus, there was no separation of church and state. The church and the state were a unity.
Well,
in many respects, in ancient times.
In Judah, they were, the Jewish religious leaders were cooperating with the Romans. Collaborating is another term that's sometimes used. It was not a theocracy in that sense at that time when Jesus was around. Earlier, when they were a more independent country, they were essentially theocratic, but not in Jesus' time.
Well, the Jewish faith was, I mean, for the years in bondage and everything else, they, to the extent that their faith was the hallmark of their social structure, there was more of a unity than there is between faith and our social structure today. And
that's probably true.
It seems to me that if you're looking at the way the society was organized in ancient times, and the way the society is organized today, says the role of religion has changed monumentally. And what the Christian right is doing, or what the Christian left is doing, it would seem to me, is pushing back toward a unity of faith and government from different perspectives. Is there any possibility, an explanation is that to have a social structure where faith and religion are really isolated, more or less, creates a tension and that this is a reaction to that?
Well, it may be. I think that historians have made a fairly plausible case that the religious vitality of the United States is in large part due to the constitutional separation of church and state. The places where you have state churches, like much of Europe, the churches are largely empty. There's no real religious vitality there at all. And I guess part of what troubles me with the religious rights movement is they want to knock the wall down, do away with the separation, without realizing most of these religious right groups wouldn't exist at all without it. Historically, they would have been dead in the waters. So I think they're extremely short-sighted then. Another point, it's easy to overestimate the unanimity within Judaism within Jesus' lifetime. There are clearly identified several different groups that had serious disagreements with each other. They're frequently mentioned in the Gospels, and also in the writings of Josephus, who was a contemporary at the time. You have the Sadducees, the Pharisees, who had very different views of things. You had the Essenes, people that were involved with doing the Dead Sea Scrolls, who may not have been the Essenes at all, as a matter of fact. But these had very different views. You also had these renegade groups that thought they were being led by Messiah to come overthrow the Romans. And they showed up every 30 or 40 years with disastrous consequences to most of the people in the country. So there was not any great unanimity even within the Judaism of Jesus' day.
Interesting point, though, about the religious right kind of abolished the separation of church and state. They're going directly against a significant part of Jesus' mission, which was a revolution against organized religion.
He was interested in instituting a kingdom of God rather than the kind of political collaboration going on between the Jews and the Romans.
And he kept all the rituals of the Roman religion, but most of the rituals of Christianity.
Christianity,
most of the rituals of Christianity predate Christ. They come directly from the Roman ritual. And, it was basically they just adjusted themselves to, they tried to avoid the problems that the Greeks had before them of maintaining a homogeneous empire and a heterogeneous, heterodietal world by going to a semi-monotheism. And it worked quite well. It kept the nobility in power for another 2,000 years.
I have a less sanguine view of the development of the church.
They have a big ritual when they get married.
I think we need to separate religious fundamentalism or conservative Christians from the politically active ones. I mean, there are a lot of religiously conservative people who, are quiet, modest, Baptist, Methodist, whatever. And then there are the politically active ones that you're talking about.
Yes.
And the politically active ones that you say, to cure them is to give them the truth. They think they have the truth.
No,
we have is not the truth. And what they're really after is power. And if you look at this historically throughout the centuries, religious organizations use their organizations to gain political power, whether it's the Egyptians or the Romans or the Middle Age Catholics. Power is the thing. That's what they want. It's not because of if they're using their religion as a vehicle
but it's after political power.
Certainly a lot of that has gone on, and I think to think the religious rights into it.
Yes, sir. Yeah, okay.
Now, the alternative view would be that individuals who seek power join the religious organization so that they can rise in the hierarchy and exercise it. And there have been tremendous battles for leadership in, among the popes and in various other organizations just for that reason. So,
well, there have been some on the religious right, too, and that's why they try to put these umbrella organizations together to do it.
Yeah, you have to distinguish between religions as organizations, which are led by people who are very good at seeking and using power, because otherwise they would fade away and religion would disappear. And what Jesus was doing, because Jesus was actually ministering to the powerless, and he was saying, again he said, that if you want to if you all want to be better off, you better support each other at the level of the lowest level, rather than trying to become very rich and so on, which is pretty impossible for the masses. Now Gandhi used that actually to get rid of the British, but there was some rather clever things that went on there too. But I think, you know, you can't say religion at all times was typified by Jesus. It was, there was this dichotomy, and there always is.
Far from it.
And in Rome, and of course the Roman authorities saw that too, that like the Republican Party, they could increase their power by giving it an aura of religious respectability.
Would you say it's economically inconsistent for the religious right to be against immigration while having the platform of free market economy and market fundamentalism?
Yeah, I think that's one of many contradictions involved in.
Is it implicit in market fundamentalism that we want labor to flow freely, perhaps?
Horizontally, yeah.
And then, so why does religious right support or legislation against abortion, pornography, and immigration, but not have support the legislation to protect the environment, help the poor, and so forth? Why the issues that they've fixed?
Well, I'm not sure. It's not part of Southern culture to do that sort of thing. The immigration issue, I suspect, has a lot to do with racism. Not uniquely that, but that's, I think, a significant part of it. If you examine the way they talk about their positions and the attitudes they manifest. But I think there are a lot of inconsistencies in the 30 categories or characteristics I spelled out there. A number of them seem to be not to match well at all.
Do you have any scriptures that speak to not imposing values on others? Are there any scriptures either in the Old Testament?
Nothing pops to mind right this minute.
Yeah.
Somebody here said, judge
not. Judge not. Judge not.
Judge
not. Judge not. The same measure you need out.
Oh, and what Jesus told the apostles, whatever you do to other people, you're doing it to me.
You mentioned the few state churches that we still have today are pretty much empty. And but I would postulate that that's because of theological liberalism, which they had to adopt in order to maintain their state status. And the example of that doesn't have to be true is Islam. Islam has a very close state and religious today, and they're very vibrant because they're very fundamentalist.
Well, in some countries they are, in other countries they're not.
Well,
Indonesia, as I understand, is the largest Muslim country in the world, and they are not essentially fundamentalists in their outlook or practices. Indonesia. So it's a mixed bag, as far as I can tell.
Let's make this question with regard to Europe and their churches. There's a really good possibility that the wars did as much to drive people away from Christianity as theology. I think they had such an experience. French, German,
you may be right, I don't know. I remember being struck by the irony of the religious right's very strong on wanting to get religion taught in public schools, have prayer and Bible reading and all of that. Well, in England, they're required to teach religion in their public schools. But it doesn't seem to solve their problem in this regard at all. Anything, it may have been counterproductive. Anyway, we've got our last question. Enjoy.
Let's give a hand or a big hand.